Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, with the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics in Leadership, dedicated to offering virtual lectures with speakers who inspire. More at viterbo.edu/ethics.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
It's a memorable day for this little show. The energy is hale and hearty. And later I'll remind you where you need to go to join us all for a party. Welcome to Spectrum West. And yes, this WPR program celebrates 25 years of providing a voice for the arts, the music, humanities, West Wisconsin. And later today, there's a party to which you are all invited, and I'll lay on those details a bit later in the show. But we have a lot to get to, including a look back 50 years at Woodstock, 3 days of peace and music that would become and remain legendary. I'm certain there were many more, but we share the memories of two West Wisconsin residents who experienced it firsthand. Jim Oliver is here with a couple of young men, one of whom is an Eau Claire native, who have seen some success with a story that's both a play and a movie. It's playing Friday and Saturday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. And let's jumpstart the show right here. I'm going to assume that most of you out there have never been to a stock dog competition. Well, that kind of fascinating happens again next weekend near Hudson, when the Wisconsin Working Stock Dog Association welcomes some of the best trainers and handlers. And here's a name you might recognize, Patricia McConnell. She represented a WPR staple for many years on a show called Calling All Pets. Welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio. This has to be a comfortable place for you to be.
Oh, it's wonderful to be back. I love radio. You know, you don't have to do your hair.
Yes. In fact, I'm dressed for radio at the moment.
Well, and that's how it should be.
If you only knew. Yeah. Well, let's talk. Calling All Pets, 14 years. It seems like only yesterday, but it's been a while since you were on with that show.
Yeah, it has been. I do, however, lucky me, I get to go on Larry Mueller's show every once in a while.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I love radio. It's really fun, and Larry's extra fun to work with. So I still get to do it every once in a while, which is just lovely.
Well, this is a loaded question, and it may take up all the time we have left. But what have you been doing since then?
Oh, nothing.
I figured, yeah.
Not a thing. Gosh, I retired from teaching at the university.
Mm-hmm.
That was hard, but, there was time. That was a good thing to do. I'm actually right now, I am crazy me, playing at writing a novel.
I read that. That's cool.
A mystery now. So I'm not only going to try and write fiction, which is so different and very challenging and very fun and exciting, but mm-hmm. I'm trying to write a mystery. So I have, I think I have 42 pages written.
I have a feeling that there's going to be zoology or animals in it somehow.
I don't know why you'd say that.
Will there be? Huh?
There will be dogs.
Yes.
There definitely will be dogs. And there will be sheep. There will be dogs, there will be sheep, and there will be people. There will be people.
Could be the allure for publishers. Maybe the only mystery novel written about sheep.
We'll see. It's a long way to that point.
Well, it's good to know you're doing well. Good to see that you're busy, because I was worried, but I'm not worried anymore.
Well, I'm glad you feel better.
Good,
I appreciate
you.
Your concern.
As we all know, August is known as the dog days of summer. Kind of takes on a whole new meaning as we speak, the Working Stock Dog Association. Competition coming up Labor Day weekend. It is dubbed as, and here's the quote from the website, 4 days of spectacular stock dog trialing, culminating in a Monday showstopper, a team-to-team double lift with the top handlers and dogs. Now, there are people out there listening who probably don't have a clue what I just talked about.
What the? First of all,
yeah.
There will be no attorneys.
Okay, good.
So a lot of times when people hear, well, they might be running their dogs, but a lot of times when people hear trial, we're talking about a legal trial. So it's a competition.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Midwest Championship Sheepdog Competition, and it's a test of both dog and handler, and it's equally hard for both. It's based on work that we all do at home.
Mm-hmm.
With our sheep, with our dogs, but it's way past that. This is a very challenging Olympic, basically, level competition that requires incredible amount of experience and intuition and training for dogs and handlers with tremendous reaction time and decision making, sheep sense and dog sense, and it's a whole lot of stuff that goes on in about a 10-minute run or so.
Yeah, it's amazing. I went a couple of years ago on a whim. I was by myself, and I stood by the fence. I was spellbound. I didn't want to leave, as a matter of fact. And I ended up walking around looking at all the people's trailers and RVs. And,
there
were dogs next to all the trailers, and they were in their little kennels, just kind of quivering, waiting to get out there and do their thing. Another quote from the website, the competition website, reads, "Come watch the country's wisest dogs and wiliest handlers compete for the coveted Midwest Sheepdog Championship." I guess dogs are wise and handlers are wily. And here are some synonyms for wily: shrewd, clever, sharp-witted, astute, crafty, cunning, artful. And here's where it kind of takes a downhill turn: sly, scheming, calculating, guileful, disingenuous, devious, and Machiavellian.
Oh, let's go with the first ones.
So you guys are wily.
Well, here's the deal. This is a really tricky sport. Part of why it's tricky is that it's about precision. And a lot of it is for the handlers knowing what's about to happen. It's sort of like a chess game at 60 miles an hour. So handlers have to be really shrewd and smart. For example, one of the tasks, can I just quickly say what
Yes. Go nuts. I was just about to describe it. I want people to learn the trainer's up on a hill, there's a big valley, and you can't even see the sheep, and then suddenly the dog takes off. You describe it. You're much better at it.
Well, no, that's a great start. First of all, the sheep are forever away. Me and my dog have just moved up to the open class, which is actually the highest level, sort of advanced class, that quite a few people are professionals. They do this for a living. They raise and train dogs. They compete. They give seminars. So it's huge. This is the biggest, baddest course in the Midwest, and it's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. So you are right. The sheep are set out by a dog and a handler way away. It could be for the open class, which is Friday and Saturday. I think it's probably about 400, 450 yards away, which is a really long way.
Yes.
When you're standing at the post, the handler has to stay in a designated place for most of it. So you're standing there with your dog way away where you can barely see the sheep, and you send your dog on what's called an outrun, which is like a half circle around to the back of the sheep. And then the dog is to bring the sheep directly to you in a straight, precise line. And the points are all about precision. If you are off the direct line by 5 feet, you're going to lose a point. And if you're still off that line in another 10 seconds, you're going to lose another couple of points. Then the dog has to swing the sheep around you and then move the sheep through a kind of a triangle course, which is through two sets of freestanding gates. And then there has to be a shed where you and the dog separate some of the sheep out from the others, and then there's a pen, and this is all under time pressure. So circling back to your question about the wily part is part of handling that I'm still learning, is knowing sort of like exactly where to place your dog. If the sheep want to go left, but you need them to go right, but if you send your dog around too fast, you might miss that panel by, you know, a half of a foot. So you start to move them a little, shift that way.
Let's tell people how you move them. Let's talk about the whistle.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I actually have mine on right now.
I forgot mine.
Oh, you did.
Oh, I sent away I have a plastic one, a metal one, and whatever. I had to do it.
Well, this is how inspiring this competition is, right? Very often we hear about people who, they're just blown away. You know, it's not just having your dog lie down when you ask when they're 500 yards away. That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
But it's all of the precision and all of the communication. So do you want me to whistle a little bit?
Yeah, and the length of the whistle and the up-down tone of it, that all signifies something
it
to the
is.
Dog.
Yes, it's a great language that you use to communicate with your dog. My favorite part is that they're verbs. For example, this means come by. This means go clockwise. All right?
Yep.
So that means go around in a big circle and go around clockwise to the back of the sheep.
And you do it a lot louder when you're up.
Yeah, a lot louder.
Because they have to hear it from
But if I want the dog to go one step clockwise, I just do the first part. I say,
wow.
Instead of, and if I want him to go fast and tight, I actually had to put my dog in the car.
I'll bet you had to,
he'd be going crazy. So there are verbs, do this, do that, do this, and they're adverbs, do this fast, do this slow, do this big, do this wide. So the communication between the handler and the dog is so sophisticated. One of the things I think people don't realize is how stressful and tense it can be for both handler and dog. It really is a very, very high-level Olympic-quality sport, a not atypical set of whistles when the dog is driving the sheep across the field can sound like, you want me to do it again? Okay, here we go.
Sure.
Can sound something like. All right, so that meant go right, go right, go right, go left, go left, stop, pause, spot, go left, spot, pause. Yeah. I mean, that's how fast. So some dogs love this, and a lot of dogs aren't suited to it because it's high-powered stuff, and it's so,
it
like you said, Al, it's so exciting to watch. It's peaceful because it's beautiful, it's green, it's hilly. There are not tons of people like there are at a fair. You can sit on a hillside in a chair, bring a blanket, hang out, free parking. It's really relaxing, but it's also exciting.
You get in the groove right away as a spectator. I use the word unknowing when I was describing spectators because anyone who's never been to one really does not know what to expect. And when you get there and you watch one or two of them, then you kind of, like I said, get in the groove and you sort of maybe end up getting on the edge of your chair and pulling for one dog or another, or there's this real old lady blowing the whistle, and I'm not talking about you.
No, not that.
Yeah. Up on the hill. So you pick your favorites, and simply because I'm a curious guide, would a person have to do all of the same whistles as everybody else, or could you come up with your own language?
Oh, everybody has different whistles.
Oh, they do. Okay.
Although my dissertation actually was derived from the fact that people tended to have very similar whistles to get dogs moving and to slow or stop them, but very different ones for direction.
Okay.
And so I thought, like, well, what's the answer to that? So there are a lot of similarities, but there are handlers who work lots of dogs, and each dog has a different set of whistles.
Okay. We are talking with Patricia McConnell, and coming up on Labor Day weekend is the 34th. How could I have only learned about it 3-4 years ago? 34th Wisconsin Working Stock Dog Association competition. It's held, as Patricia said, at a wonderful location, which is Badlands Snow Park. That's, again, near Hudson. If you want more information as we conclude our conversation, the website is wwsda.com. It's Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, it's 8 to 5. Monday, which is the double lift, which is extra, extra exciting and amazing, it's 9 to 3. And a really fun thing to do.
Open to the public. It's affordable. Open competition Friday and Saturday. On Sunday, there are things that I don't know what they mean. I don't know what nursery is.
It's for young dogs. So it's a big course.
Okay.
They still have to run a long way. Mm-hmm. Very challenging, but the dogs have to be under a certain age, 2.5-ish or so.
Okay.
And then Pro Novice is an intermediate class, basically. It's the class Maggie and I are just moving up from. And then I should quickly mention that we have a gray muzzle section of the open competition. That's for dogs who are 9 or older.
Oh,
so
wow.
There'll be a special award for the older dogs.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought up her name because you've said my dog a couple times that she should be identified. Maggie is your border collie.
Maggie.
How old is Maggie?
Maggie is 6, and she had a serious injury last summer, so we couldn't trial, so we sort of lost a year. But she's just moving up, and she is my pet dog, too. She's our family dog. She's on the couch every night. And I will just say, she's not perfect, but I love her as much as life itself, and she and I are going to go out there and kick butt as best we can.
I'll bet, and I'll bet you she loves you back.
Yeah, she does.
Just quickly, I'm curious, not because it doesn't seem to fit, it fits perfectly. How did Patricia McConnell get into this?
I got into it, believe it or not, through research. Yeah, I was looking for a senior honors thesis, and I wanted to do something that had to do with humans and animals communicating in some way. I had that inherent interest, and I went to my senior advisor. I said, you know, I think I want to study language between people and dolphins. And he said, okay, you're in the Midwest.
Yes.
He said, you could do a literature review, but you couldn't do any research. What about looking at communication between herding dogs and handlers? That's a great thing. You could do research on it. I thought that was a horrible idea. I actually drove home going like, oh, that was just stupid. Where am I going to find anybody who works herding dogs? I found Jack Knox outside of Montello, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I just fell off the cliff, and I did a lot of recordings, and then I went to an event in Arizona, and then I ended up, for my dissertation, I actually ended up traveling around the country. I went to Texas. I spent a summer on sheep ranches recording Basque sheep herders, and actually recorded 14 different languages communicating with working animals, dogs, horses. Yeah, I did my whole dissertation on that. And then I just sort of got sucked both personally and professionally into the whole thing. I bought a border collie, and a couple years later, I bought a farm and the world's most expensive dog toy, pretty much, farm and sheep. And I had to take a pause from it when I was traveling so much for my work, doing seminars. I was just gone all the time. But so I'm back, and it's incredibly engaging and fun and a way to interact with a dog in a very... oh, a very deep, rich, and satisfying way.
Yeah. The last person I talked to about this event was a couple of years ago. It was Alistair McRae.
Oh.
And it was interesting to yak with him because it sort of brought me into the whole international field. And I said, well, hey, has anyone brought a herding pig, Babe?
After Babe, right.
Yeah. And right. I said, someone should do that eventually, I guess.
Someone could, yeah. Alistair, he's one of the gods of our field. He will not be there this time, but a dynasty, the Watt family, Gordon Watt, Carrie Watt, and their daughter Sophie, are three of the top handlers in the country. They will be there. Sophie's our youngest competitor. She can just kick butt. She's phenomenal, believe me. So, yeah, there's some top handlers that will be there.
Good deal. Please be sure to let us know when the novel is finished, because I want to yak it with you.
Oh, thank you.
When that's done, too.
Thank
right.
you.
Hey, good luck.
Wish us luck. Yeah, our second time in this big, huge class.
We'll bring cheerleaders.
Right,
I might
I'll
come over. I'm gonna yell at you if I do.
Come say hi. Oh, you better. Thank you so much. I so appreciate it.
No big plans for the Labor Day weekend? Want to do something special that you've never done before? That's it. WWSDA.com again is the website. See you there. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Simply Dunn in Downsville, home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery influenced by nature, including tableware, vases, and cookware. More at simply-dunn.com. Hey, Jim Oliver's here to answer the question, what's on stage in West Wisconsin?
Thank you, sir. A gentleman and a scholar will wrap up the 59th summer season of the Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake. The show will be playing through Sunday. Ole and Lena Cafe Chaos will be staged by Cumberland ETC Friday and Saturday in the Cumberland Arts Center. Crimes of the Heart is running through Sunday in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater in St. Croix Falls. The play is being produced by the Festival Theater. And A Gun and a Motel Bible will be staged Friday and Saturday in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. I'm Jim Oliver.
Well, I'll tell you what. That last item, while we have him, yet another West Wisconsin natural is making his mark in the world of theater and entertainment. Jim found the story, found the people, and now we find time to tell you about it.
Pete's got a gun, and he's ready to use it. He checks into a motel room, only to find Gideon, the chatty Bible, on the bedside table. As ideas about morality, the Bible, and God flow, the clock ticks. Well, that's the opening of a publicity piece about a production of the play Gun and a Motel Bible. It's the creation of Eau Claire Memorial High School graduate Daniel Florin and his co-playwright Bradley Gosnell. The show will play Friday and Saturday in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Joining us by telephone are the aforementioned playwrights who took the play to last year's Hollywood Fringe Festival, where it won 3 awards and was nominated for a 4th. Bradley, as I understand it, you had the original idea and talked Daniel into joining in the process. So what turned on the light bulb for you?
Well, so the idea was from a Beatles song, Rocky Raccoon. The chorus of that song is Rocky Raccoon checks into a room only to find Gideon's Bible. And that's sort of the premise. And Rocky's come with a gun. He's going to shoot his wife's lover. And it's this sort of hokey Paul McCartney song. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun if the Bible was personified? Rocky and we'll have this conversation while he was waiting to kill his wife's lover. And I'd just seen a production of The Screwtape Letters, which really influenced me. And the idea of personifying something was really appealing. It seemed like the perfect thing for it. So I spent some time with it, I guess about 2 years before Dan got involved, and wrote about 20 pages or so, and stopped and wrote a whole new 20 pages or so. Dan and I have been working together for so long, and it just, the idea sort of hit me that this was the time, and he was the guy to write it with. Dan and I were talking about doing Fringe, or discussing it, or having some ideas around it, and then this idea kind of occurred to me. So we sat down at Panera, and I pitched him the story, and you know, the guy was, I was fortunate enough to have him on board, and the rest is history.
So you pretty much got into what the story is about, but it sounds like a kind of a complex tale. I haven't read it nor seen it, but it sounds a little complicated.
The trip from song to play and sort of being inspired by the music and not necessarily trying to adapt it meant that, one, we thought we should change the character's name from Rocky to Pete, but Peter being the rock the church was built on felt apropos. We felt clever about that. But just in general, we wanted to add more to it, more, wanted to give it a stronger narrative, really invest in the character, Pete, and why he does what he does, and why dramatically, poetically, the Bible is the perfect counterpoint to that. So we added a backstory that wasn't there in the song. We put in a narrative, and we were really specific with the themes that we wanted, which leads into how you write the Bible, which was, I think, initially the toughest thing about it was, how are we going to write a conversation with a Bible that we thought was evenly handed, that someone could walk in and not be a Christian, not be devout, and maybe even have gripes against Christianity and still feel like that their voices were heard? And how do we also represent the Bible well and truthfully and compassionately and loving, and how someone who is a Christian, is devout, would maybe look at Dan's amazing performance and not think, oh, that's how I read my Bible, but to be able to empathize, relate, and feel spoken for in that representation. So those are sort of the big jumps from song to script, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Where we spend most of our time, and honestly, it feels like it's the thing that makes the show tick, you know?
Mm-hmm. He is Bradley Gosnell, one of the playwrights, along with Eau Claire native Daniel Florin of the play Gun and a Motel Bible. Well, Daniel, talk about the characters. There's two of you, I guess. And what led to adapting the play into a movie?
The characters that we've got that we're starting with are Pete, and Pete is the guy with the gun in Gun in a Motel Bible. So Pete's had a lot of, I don't want to give anything away, but what I'll say is that Pete's got a lot burning in him.
Uh-huh.
He's got a lot of history. There's good reasons that he walks into this motel room with a gun. The last thing that he wants is for anyone to talk to him, least of all Gideon, the Bible on the bedside table personified. Some ways he'll be exactly what you expect. He'll have a tattered old cover and he says Bible verses, but in many ways, it'll probably not quite be the Bible that you expect, because the way we write Gideon is this chipper, eager, earnest little book who's really excited to have a friend. And in walks Pete, growly, angry guy, and Gideon couldn't be happier that he's got a friend finally. And so the counterpoint of where these two characters start, Gideon being so excited that someone's there and Pete being very not happy that someone's there, is what kind of gives us the tension at the top of the play that's going to take us all the way through the last beat.
Tell me a little bit about how this is staged. I guess what I'm asking you about is the set.
What's staged is a motel room.
Mm-hmm.
So in the script, it's a motel room that's run down, not seedy, but not in the nicest part of town. A bed and a bedside table, a little chair to sit in, maybe a little desk, chest of drawers, and not much else. But it is Gideon's motel room. So while it's old and shabby, it's home for him.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a director as well.
Mm-hmm. Alicia LeBlanc, and she's amazing. We were five drafts in on the script, and she's an excellent writer. And we were like, hey, Alicia, can you like just give us script notes? And she read the script, and by the way, she's also a phenomenal actor. Me and Bradley both know her from an acting class, and she's one of the best actors I've ever seen. In any case, we had her read the script, and she came in, and me and Bradley at the time were looking for a director, and we kind of didn't know where to start. And then Alicia said, hey, Are you guys looking for a director? This is the kind of thing that I would love to direct. And that was pretty much all we needed, because Alicia also, along with Bradley and myself, in addition to having a real heart and a real vision for stories and telling them well and telling them in a way that's funny and is warm but also honest and incisive, she also has a storied history of with Christianity and with God and exploring what that means to her. And that's an important, that was an important part of the play to us that we wanted our director to have resonance with. And she was just the perfect director for this project. She is an absolute angel. She's incredible. She's going to be coming up to the play with us. She's helping us restage it up in Eau Claire at the Grand.
You've made it into a movie already. What led you to do that, and what was the process?
So originally when we did the play, we did it at a tiny little 21-seat theater in Hollywood, and we thought that that'd be the end of it. But our opening night, we had the director-producer team from Embrace Productions come. They just loved it. They came to every single show except for the shows that we asked them not to come to so we'd have more seats. But they came to all the shows, and they said, hey, we want to do the movie. We said, wait, really? Is that real? And they said, yep, let's do it. That's what started. And so we started adapting the play into a screenplay and went pretty much straight into pre-production, and got the movie finished. And right now it's going to be premiering at film festivals this fall.
All right, Bradley, your theatrical background.
My theatrical background is pretty much my background. I've spent my whole life doing theater, seeing theater, enjoying theater, performing theater. I was a theater major in college. And the concept of this being a profession was all I ever needed to want to do it. My background with the theater is primarily as an actor, acting, performing, entertaining. And as I moved through college, my emphasis on story, I took a directing class and I really enjoyed that. And sort of my capabilities in just the art and craft of being a part of a theater expanded. And then after college in Los Angeles, spent a lot of time with independent theaters and very quickly saw how I wanted to run things better. I'm a part of producing. I've since directed a lot of shows out here. I've done set design. I've done fight choreography. I've done choreography. A buddy of mine, we started a Shakespeare company that does front yard Shakespeare called Irreverent Shakespeare, which has been a blast. My experience and relationship with the theater is just ongoing and ever present. I currently teach theater at a high school. So, gosh, it's a lot.
Well, Daniel, what happened to you after you left Memorial High School of beautiful Eau Claire? Where did you go to college? What got you started in this theatrical bent?
So after I left Eau Claire, I went to TCU in Fort Worth, Texas, which is where me and Bradley met. Uh-huh. Bradley was a theater major and I was a film major. And as I was getting out of high school, I started leaning towards film and film acting. So when I got to college, they didn't have a film acting program, but they had a great theater program, and they had a film production program. So I did the film production major and a theater minor, took as many of the acting classes as they'd let me take. And while I was over in the theater department, one of the best ways to grow as an actor was to do theater. And so I started doing theater over there with them. And I drew on a lot of what I did in Eau Claire. I ended up doing a lot of musicals. Through high school, I was doing show choir. So I did lots and lots of singing and dancing school. And then that kind of transitioned to doing musical theater and then film acting through college. And after that, moved out to Los Angeles and went from there.
Well, what's ahead for the movie? You're going to be showing the movie at festivals where?
Right now, what we already have on the docket is the Content 19 Film Festival in Dallas. And we're nominated for 9 awards, which we're really super excited about, and the CFFF Festival in New York.
And what about the play? Are you going to take it anywhere else? Do you have any plans for it?
Oh, it depends on how much love Wisconsin gives us, I guess.
Okay.
What's nice for the play for us, obviously we've written it and we've produced it now. We're third time producing it on stage. And we feel such a connection to it. Speaking about Alicia earlier, for us, for the director, and I think for anyone who sees it, it asks that you be authentic with it and authentic with your beliefs. And that can be something that is healthy to do. And so we really enjoy working on this. We really enjoyed writing it. We really enjoyed discussing it, and we really enjoy performing it. So in some ways, I hope we're never really done with the show. Thankfully, we didn't write the characters with too stringent age ranges. but right now, theatrically, after Eau Claire, we'll probably look on maybe doing it on some college campuses. But apart from that, we're just going to see what the film brings us and then try to ride that energy in the theater when and wherever we can.
Well, the play is Gun and a Motel Bible. Performances are set for Friday and Saturday evenings in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, you can call the theater box office at 715-832-PLAY. We've been talking to the playwrights, Eau Claire native Daniel Florin and Bradley Gosnell. Gentlemen, best wishes to you on the film, and congratulations on your success so far.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thank you, Mr. Oliver. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, and support for WPR comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, a locally owned community bank now offering new checking account options with personalized customer service. More information is available at charterbank.bank. Ten years ago, on the 40th anniversary of Woodstock, I discovered John Steadman, an Eau Claire resident who had been there. We had a marvelous conversation. Since then, I've met yet another attendee, River Falls poet and Cornell, Wisconsin native Thomas Smith. So I thought, hey, great, on the occasion of this month's 50th anniversary, I'll have two guests to celebrate. They can compare notes and delight in the brotherhood. Thomas was up for it, but I had not spoken to John in several years, so I went online to find his contact information. And what I found was his obituary from 3 years ago. The hollow feeling of having lost a friend came over me. We hadn't been in touch, but nonetheless shared the connection that members of a generation often do. I'd hereby like to publicly offer belated and sincere condolences for the loss of a very good man to the Steadman family. However, here today, with their assurance that John would love it, he returns in spirit with his previous recollections and compares those notes with Thomas Smith, who joins us by telephone, and who, by the way, has written what I consider to be the ultimate Woodstock verse, which we will hear later. So, August of 1969, John Steadman was 19 years old. He was going to school. He was living on Long Island, so he didn't have that far to go, but I asked how he had heard about Woodstock.
I didn't know anything about it. My buddy says, hey, what are you doing for the weekend? I said, nothing. He said, do you want to go to a party or concert or something? And I said, sure. We set out early Friday morning and stuck out our thumbs. And, you know, it took us probably six hours to get there, seven hours to get there. A good portion of our ride was in the proverbial yellow VW microbus. You know,
wow.
It was like perfect.
That's great. So he hitchhiked. I've just heard about it from a friend. He said they had to walk about the last 4 to 5 miles to get to the location. Thomas, what was your experience in finding out about it?
Well, living in a Wisconsin small town is quite a lot different from John's. We had been following ads for Woodstock in what it's called the Underground Press, and we sent for tickets. Six of us converged at my little house on Thursday morning, jumped in the car and drove all night, and got within 7 miles, I think, of the festival site. That was our hike.
Well, I was telling you before we started recording, I found an article all about Woodstock in the new Saturday Evening Post, and yes, you can still get that magazine, folks. And I read that organizers had planned on charging $18 in advance for a 3-day pass or $24 at the gate, and I read in this article that they in fact did sell 186,000 advance tickets, so you were one of those.
Yes, and because there in fact were no tickets being taken at all any time there, yeah. I still have mine,
yes.
Pristine set of 3 tickets, $6 a piece.
That's cool. So back to John Steadman. My next question was, what was it like when you arrived?
We didn't know where we were going. There were signs, but there was also a crush of people. We didn't have tickets, never paid a dime. We were prepared to buy tickets. I remember a big chain link fence I remember nervous looking sort of people, because there was clearly more people there than anyone was prepared for. You could see the gate, but we were a long ways from the gate because we were just separated by a mob of people. We were sort of wondering how we were going to funnel into this, what looked like a gate. And then all of a sudden, we just found ourselves running through this 100-yard gap in the fence. You know, I never saw a ticket taker the whole time I was there.
Kind of the same thing you were talking about, Thomas. But you had tickets, so you were looking for a place to give them.
Well, yeah, but not very long. You know, we got the picture pretty fast, and there wasn't anything that even resembled a fence or a gate around that place. And we just wandered in with that whole unbelievable caravan of people that were streaming in from all over every which way. And we got lost from each other. Really didn't all find each other until Sunday morning. It was miraculous. I don't know how we did it.
No kidding.
But the festival was well underway by the time we straggled in on Friday evening on foot. And I remember sleeping under some Philly hippie's tarp and with it raining in the bushes.
I was interested in talking with John Steadman 10 years ago because they hitchhiked. They didn't really know where they were going. I was interested in what they all brought along.
We were well-traveled hitchhikers. We had each a backpack. We each had a sleeping bag. One of us carried a tent. We were set up to camp and enjoy ourselves. But we lost all that stuff. We lost all that stuff the first night in the rain. We're down to our shorts, you know, within 24 hours of arriving there. We were very, very quickly down to bare essentials.
How well prepared were you guys, Thomas?
I'm sure we were less well prepared than John was. We were just winging it. And one of the people along on our gang, Mike, says that the sleeping bag that he brought along got his dad through France, Italy, and other places in World War II, but was swallowed by the mud of Maxie Asker's farm. A couple other people along with us also lost their sleeping bags. If you see the pictures immediately after, you just have to have visions of landfill.
That was crazy stuff. So we've always heard that the one thing for which Woodstock was most famous was the conduct and the disposition of the people. With a crowd that large in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands, chances were good that something other than the weather would go wrong. I wondered to John Steadman if that was true.
I did not witness any friction, any anger, person to person, in the whole thing. The law was present and nervous, but it was remarkably peaceful. And the freedom to do whatever struck your fancy. I learned things that I had not yet known by attending that place and that time. Just a fantastic exclamation point on my summer.
So, Thomas, what did you witness?
You know, John was totally right about the peacefulness of it, and I think, you know, in retrospect, 50 years on, immediately after the festival, you know, for a year or two, it was all about the music. It was completely the music in our heads, the things that we'd seen and heard. But 50 years later, it doesn't even seem to me that the music was the big event. The big event was the people who attended. And if anybody's seen the recent PBS documentary on Woodstock that's been airing, they got it right. In some ways, it was a miraculous feat of generosity, kindness, sharing. As a human feat, it was extraordinary. I think that's what made it historic.
Richie Havens, John Sebastian, Arlo Guthrie, Joan Baez, Santana, Canned Heat, Grateful Dead, CCR, Sly and the Family Stone, Janis Joplin, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, 10 years after, Joe Cocker, Country Joe and the Fish, The Band, Blood, Sweat and Tears, Johnny Winter, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Young was there too, I guess, Paul Butterfield, Sha-na-na, Jimi Hendrix, and more. Here's people who were invited to appear but declined. The Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Bob Dylan, The Byrds, Jethro Tull, The Moody Blues. And I asked John Steadman, and we'll ask Thomas, to talk about the music and wondered if there was one thing that he most remembered about the musical experience.
I wasn't a big guy on groups. I didn't know a lot of these groups until Woodstock, but I was just totally blown away by the degree to which they were just enjoying themselves. It was clear that they had never seen anything on that scale, and they weren't putting on a show so much as they were there just jamming. And there was the main acts that you read off, and there was stuff going on the side all around.
So, Thomas, in doing a lot of reading about Woodstock, I wish I had been there because I could have. I'm the same age as a lot of you guys. I realized that a lot of people, in the end, didn't get to see the Biggies. They were off doing something else or who knows what. How about you? What about the musical experience?
Yeah, there was definitely two kinds of people there. There were the, you know, strollers around, and then there were people that were glued to their butts for hours and hours and hours. And I was one of the latter. I don't even know where the swimming hole was because I just stayed and listened to music. But I have two memories that particularly stand out among all of the others. One of them on the big main stage was The Who. And my fellow Woodstockers and I, who have our periodic reunions, always get in conversations about who the greatest act there was. And there's at least a couple of us that say The Who. The Who were fantastic. That's one for me. And then another one is a more low-keyed moment. There was a little, we call it a little folky stage, way in back by where the hog farm had their free kitchen. And I remember sitting there with, you know, maybe 100, 150 people in the grass with Joan Baez doing an informal chatty set, you know, maybe 50 feet away from us. It was as relaxed as being in a coffee house. To me, those are the two wonderful particular memories. Do you know the Hendrix set that's so famous?
Mm-hmm.
The irony of that was that Hendrix's manager insisted on him being the headliner for the whole festival, which meant he had to play last, so the whole thing got shoved back till Monday morning, and they lost 90% of the audience. So that famous Hendrix Star-Spangled Banner, only a tiny minority of the Woodstock attendants actually got a chance to hear that in person.
We are talking about Woodstock 50 years later. Thomas R. Smith, who lives in River Falls, well-known poet, is on the phone with us, and we are remembering John Steadman, the late John Steadman, who was with me 10 years ago. John and I talked about the 40th anniversary, and we're pulling up some of his memorable comments. The Saturday Evening Post article, which has statistics in it, had some interesting things. For instance, the first act that was signed for Woodstock was Creedence Clearwater Revival. There were as many as three births that happened there. And you just brought up the hog farm. Wavy Gravy, of course, was a big figure around there, and you're going to mention it in a new poem that you wrote. They supplemented the waning food supply with granola, which became a counterculture staple after Woodstock, which I found interesting. And here, the bathroom situation, they had 600 portable toilets, and that figures out to about one for roughly every 833 people.
Well, you have to remember how young we were. When my friends and I who'd gone to Woodstock were getting together the other day and talking about it, there's not a one of us that can even remember going to the bathroom.
That's weird. Well, you brought up
a bunch of 60 and 70-year-olds, it'd be a different story.
So I was curious about if there was one thing that you most remembered about the experience, and this was John Steadman's reply.
Mud. I think I got home on Wednesday. I was caked with mud, bareback, barefoot. I had this kind of brown mask in my hair, in between my toes.
For what it's worth, I don't have any mud experience at all. So.
Okay. I wondered in my chat 10 years ago with John Steadman if he ever felt like he had been to something that would be historic. And Thomas, I'll ask you the same thing. Here was John's reply.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I didn't want to predict, I couldn't predict how it would be remembered, but I knew I was part of something very special. I mean, we got more rain. I forget what people said we got, but I think we got 6 or 7 inches of rain in as many hours. You know, it would ruin a lot of events, but it sort of just seemed like perfect. So there was this spirit, this real sense of fun, uh-huh. of uninhibited kind of action, and some damn fine music.
So, Thomas, I have a feeling that you maybe had an inkling that it was going to be big because you had the wherewithal to save a program, you told me.
Yeah. At one point, it was announced from the stage that we had become the second largest city in New York State.
Oh, wow.
So we knew it was big. But I think the spirit of the times as well, you know, the assassinations have been going on and the Vietnam War, and a lot of us felt almost literally under the gun. And just being there with, you know, 500,000 kindred souls, it felt like a small revolution in itself. And I don't think any of us who were there had any doubt that this was something that would shake down through the rest of our lives as a really key moment.
I'm going to play John Steadman's reply to the question, was there one song that he remembers the most? I'll ask you the same thing. What is it?
If I had to pick one song, it would have to be a Who song, and it's probably the one at the climax of Tommy, which they played a shortened version of. It's the one, you know, gazing at you, I see the millions, looking at you, I see the glory. Felt like they were singing to us, you know, the half million out there gathered. It was a really spiritual moment. It was something really transcendent.
How many pieces have you written about Woodstock over the years, being the stellar poet that you are?
Actually, only two.
Okay.
But the first one was kind of a first-hand experience poem, and I tried to write it for many years, and finally I think I got it right a couple of years ago after, you know, slaving away on it for about 10 at least. And, you know, just a couple of weeks ago I wrote a new one which zooms out from the personal experience and the personal chronicle and tries to get at more of, you know, the larger significance that both John and I and you have been circling around in this set of interviews.
I'm hoping, Thomas, that you will share that poem. Do you have it with you?
I do.
I can't wait. And then we'll get to John and his favorite song, and then we'll wrap it up. We'll pretend that we're all leaving Woodstock.
Okay. So the poem is called Woodstock, 50th Anniversary, August 2019. Soon the forgetting will resume, so let's talk about it now. Youth in upheaval, Nixon, Vietnam, the assassinations, our parents' world stripped of its veneer of stability, and worse, its honor. And our flawed, fast-burning prophets, all their music delivering the single message, live. What magnificent soothsaying. Hendrix's shockingly faithful salute to our bullet-riddled flag. A man with that kind of arsenal at his fingertips couldn't live long. It was all in place for that convergence that could have turned demonic, but came out angelic instead. Wavy Gravy in his white coveralls and impossible hat proclaimed from the stage heaven, and he wasn't wrong. The darkness had grown deep enough for the light to burst through. And for an illuminated moment, we all stood in it together. It wouldn't last. We, its imperfect vessel, couldn't hold it. Maybe no one could, but a few weird saints. But just for it to have shone, however briefly, through a whole generation, was something new. It was big, a miracle even, the miracle that dispelled the hunger and fear and broke the darkness into loaves and fishes, enough to feed half a million. Happened before. It could happen again. That weekend, the Eternal slipped the bonds of Eastern Standard Time, a victory of peacefulness over violence, plenty over scarcity, sharing over selfishness. Though it couldn't last, though we couldn't keep it, we weren't wrong to want it. Those who still want it aren't wrong.
You have to publish that so that everyone who attended Woodstock and all of those like me who wish they had can read that. I told you earlier, that's one of the best poems I've ever heard you write and read.
Well, I think you're pushing me to pop it into my next book.
Well, that's definitely for sure, but man, that guy just did it all in that little span of time.
Well, I do have a website. I might think about that.
You should. Well, Thomas, thanks for spending time with me, and I'm going to get to John's answer. You're a good friend of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's remember what John Steadman said was his favorite, the one song that he took home with him.
Oh, be freedom. Richie Havens doing his freedom. And to my knowledge, he has never done it that way. And because of the huge traffic jam and the deteriorating weather, he just got out. They sort of pushed him out there on the stage and said, play until we find somebody to play after you. And he kept looking off to the side, and his rendition, he just ad-libbed. He ad-libbed a good majority of it. Couldn't tell you any specifics, but can't remember any. But I just... the whole experience of that song, that song will take me back right now.
Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Well, I guess wow would be a good word. Before we do anything else, I want to invite you to a party that's being put on for you. We are celebrating you and 25 years of this show, Spectrum West. It's coming up later today, and it all gets underway at 5 p.m. at the beautiful River Prairie Center in Altoona. You've been hearing people talk about it on the air for the last week or two. Come on over, enjoy some music, some snacks, and shake hands with some WPR folks from around here and Madison. And again, it's your party. It's a listener party. That's what it's called. That's you. You're the listener. So hope to see you later. We're going to take next week off, so have a happy and safe Labor Day weekend. We will return on September 5. Thanks and best wishes to intern Allison as she moves on. Thanks to Dean and Kate, and thank you guys for lending us your ears as you do each week. For Jim Oliver, Catherine Thomas, everybody involved, thanks again. We'll see you in a couple weeks.